As the chief weapons inspector for the United Nations Special Commission to Iraq, Scott Ritter was labeled a hero by some, a maverick by others, and a spy by the Iraqi government. In charge of searching out weapons of mass destruction within Iraq, Scott was on the front lines of the ongoing battle against arms proliferation. His experiences in enemy territory served as the basis for his book Endgame. He has now produced a documentary in Shifting Sands, which I highly recommend to you. Scott's the father of 2 9-year-old girls. He proves to us what one committed man, living his integrity every single day, can do. And this is the part I think he won't tell you. You know, this government was ready to pull a fast one on us and say the Iraqi government will never let the arms inspectors back in. This brave and kind and gentle man took himself to a meeting with Tariq Aziz out of Iraq and then went back into Iraq, met with Tariq Aziz and high officials of the Iraqi government, told them this was a matter of life and death. Either they let those weapons inspectors back in, or they would die. When we were in Iraq in May, we met with Tariq Aziz. He and every other person we met said, "We are afraid that we will die." Citizens living in poverty, citizens barely able to maintain themselves, terrified of you and me. Just a few days after those critical meetings, Iraq said the weapons inspectors can come back in. Scott Ritter is a hero. But he doesn't want you to think this is a personal thing for him. He wants you to know that this is my responsibility for telling on him. Okay? God bless you, Scott.
I just took a picture there. Well, thanks for fibbing on me. Certainly is a pleasure to be here tonight. Whoop, flip it up. Now, can everybody hear me? Okay. I haven't been this wired since the last time the FBI visited my home, so you gotta forgive me. But if you guys understood how nervous I am to be up here and speaking in front of you, so forgive me if I have any lapses. I'm not a professional public speaker. I'm here as a private American citizen, in solidarity with you, my fellow citizens, about an issue of grave concern. That issue is, frankly speaking, a life and death decision, or life and death issue for thousands, many of whom might be in this room, most of whom aren't. Thousands of Americans, thousands of Iraqis, thousands of citizens of the world. I'm talking about war. The coming war with Iraq. Now, I've been speaking about the coming war with Iraq for years now, and even as recently as June, when I spoke before a group of congressmen, and they were Republicans, by the way, the Democrats, I think, had a clue what was happening, but the Republicans were trying to delude themselves, and I think I need to be, truth in advertising here. I am a Republican, card-carrying Republican, conservative, moderate in my political views, and I voted for George W. Bush for president, so I'm not up here to make a political statement, to bash the president, to bash the Republicans. I am a Republican. I'm up here as an American citizen concerned about the direction my country is going in. Now, for the past 4 years, I've been confronting the American people with the real probability of war between the United States and Iraq. And I've been treated sort of like the boy who cries wolf, or, Chicken Little, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And everybody said, "No, Scott, there's not going to be a war. It's really not going to happen." And as recent as June, Republicans in Congress, "Scott, the president will not lead us down the path to war. He's just bluffing. He's trying to get the Iraqis to cave in." Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war. That's the fact, unless something's done to stop it. How can we stop this war? And that's what we're talking about. Now, I hope none of you are in here tonight to feel good about yourselves, to say, you know, hey, I went to that presentation. Aren't I a good citizen? I feel really good about myself. I've traveled around the country. I've traveled around the world, and I've seen a lot of desire. I've seen a lot of desire for peace. A lot of people desire peace. A lot of people want peace. Very few will peace. Do you have the will for peace? This is the question you have to ask yourself. Do you have the will? Because it's going to take will. It's probably the FBI wanting to know directions to tonight's event. But what I want to talk to you tonight is about this coming war. But in order to address this, I really want to talk to you about some pieces of paper. And I want you to reflect on pieces of paper. The first piece of paper I want you to reflect on is a document that was signed a couple hundred years ago called the Constitution of the United States of America. It's an important document, important in a number of ways. One, it defines who we are as a people. And it says we are a people respectful of laws, a nation of laws. We're a people who respect human rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It speaks of, and this is what you need to get into your heads, it speaks of we, the people of the United States of America. It speaks of government of the people, by the people, for the people. If you sit here and say that the American government is leading us down the path to hell, no, you are. You're to blame. You're the government. What are you doing to stop this war? Is the question you have to ask yourself over and over again. And it's not a rhetorical question, it's a real question, because the Constitution puts the responsibility for the running of this country firmly in your hands, in our hands. We, the people of the United States of America. That's the first piece of paper I want you to consider. The second piece of paper I'd like you to consider is the Gettysburg Address. And the reason why I bring this up is that the Gettysburg Address is a document that more eloquently than most I can think of discusses why democracies like ours go to war. Now let's talk about war for a second. I don't think too many people talk about the reality of war. We're on the verge of war with Iraq. This is not a Nintendo game. When you die, you don't hit reset and come back to life. War is real. Real. I'm a 12-year veteran in the Marine Corps. When I took my Marines onto the firing line to shoot at paper targets from 200, 300, 500 meters or yards, it wasn't because the United States of America liked to punch holes in white pieces of paper. I'm training my Marines to send 5.56 millimeters of copper or jacketed metal downrange to penetrate a human body, to rip that body apart, to kill somebody. That's why we train to shoot, to kill. When I sat up on a hill as a Marine with a radio in my hand, calling down artillery and airstrikes on piles of tires in the deserts of California, it wasn't because the United States government had a grudge against Goodyear. It's because they were training me to rain death and destruction down on human beings. Ladies and gentlemen, war is about death. War is about destruction. There is nothing good about war. We must avoid war at all costs. But there comes a time. There comes a time when nations such as ours must defend ourselves. When nations such as ours have to stand up and fight for what we believe in. The fields of Europe, the fields of the United States, are covered with cemeteries with white crosses and stars of David, marking those who have gone before us, those who have laid down their lives in sacrifice for this great country. And sometimes you do have to pay that price. And Abraham Lincoln reflected on this when he was standing at the battlefield of Gettysburg, looking out on the fields where thousands of Americans had perished. And he wondered why they had to die. And his answer was as such: so that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the face of the earth. Ladies and gentlemen, the only reason we should ever go to war is to preserve our nation, to preserve our way of life. That is what is worthy of the sacrifice of American lives, nothing more, nothing less. So I want you to consider the third document, third piece of paper, the United Nations Charter. We're signatories to the United Nations Charter. The United Nations Charter was created in the aftermath of a horrible global conflict, World War II. And the global community, the community of nations, realized that we can't keep going down this path. This is a path towards annihilation, death. We have to find a way to peacefully coexist. So they formed a community of nations, and they signed a charter. And the charter said, we are committed to peaceful resolution of conflict. Now, the charter also recognized that sometimes you have to defend yourself. It wasn't a utopian concept. They recognized the reality of the world. So the charter set forth conditions under which nations could go to war. First condition, self-defense. If you're attacked, you have the right to defend yourself. The charter recognizes this in Article 51. And we do have a modern-day example to fall back on and consider. September 11th, 2001, our nation was attacked. 19 hijackers took over 4 airplanes, flew them into buildings, and in a span of less than 100 minutes, nearly 3,000 innocent Americans perished. And we found that we had been attacked. And the Security Council of the United Nations likewise recognized this and recognized the United States had the right under Article 51 to defend itself. And we were able to build a coalition of nations under the rule of law to go out and bring to justice those who perpetrated the horrific events on us. Now, you may have problems, as I do, with the way we are waging the war on terror. But what I'm telling you is that we are right to defend ourselves. It is something that is permitted under the rule of law. It doesn't make war any good, any less evil, any better. It just means that under the rule of law, we can do this. Second example. The United Nations Charter recognizes that there are times when the international community can collectively find out that one nation or non-nation represents a clear and present risk to international peace and security. And under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, can pass a resolution authorizing certain actions, up to and including military force, to hold that nation or group accountable. Example, when Iraq invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, the Security Council passed Resolution 678 that said, this will not stand. Iraq's actions represent a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and they authorized a coalition of nations to be formed and go in and liberate Kuwait. Not a good war, but a war that was legitimized by the rule of law. I'm not trying to condone war. I'm telling you that under the rules as set forth by international law, there are conditions under which nations may go to war. Now, understand that we have signed the United Nations Charter. And in accordance with our Constitution, any international agreement we enter into, any treaty we enter into, carries the force of law here at home. So keep this in mind. If the United States of America enters into a war with anyone that does not meet one of those two criteria, it is a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America. It represents a frontal assault on American democracy. So now let's consider the war on Iraq. Why are we going to war on Iraq?
Oil.
Besides oil.
Hillary.
No, we're going to war on Iraq because Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Iraq, well, we're not going to war on ourselves. We're going to war against Iraq because they have weapons of mass destruction. We're going to war on Iraq because Iraq is a state sponsor of terror. We're going on Iraq, war on Iraq, because Iraq is in cahoots with those who perpetrated the attack on us on September 11th, 2001. We're going to war against Iraq because we're concerned Iraq's going to take its weapons of mass destruction, give it to those who perpetrated the attack, and they'll attack us again. But this time, we're told by the President of the United States, this time it'll be worse. More Americans will die. And you know what? A lot of people hear this around the country, and they're scared. They say, my God, we can't let this happen. We have to confront this. We have to go forth and defend ourselves. And that's why you have so many Americans who claim to support a war against Iraq today. The problem is, none of what I just said is true. Weapons of mass destruction? Yeah, Iraq had them. And the international community found that Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction represented a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and they authorized a group of weapons inspectors to go into Iraq and disarm them, get rid of these weapons. And off the inspectors marched. Well, let's talk about this for a second. You see, the Security Council passed a resolution 687 saying Iraq can't have chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles. And they linked Iraq's disarmament to lifting of economic sanctions that had been imposed on Iraq when they invaded Kuwait in August 1990. Now, the sanctions were supposed to be lifted when Kuwait was liberated, but they weren't. They were extended, this time linked to Iraq's ability to comply with an obligation to disarm. Now, on the surface, it appears what this resolution is talking about is the disarmament of Iraq. But let's dig a little deeper, ladies and gentlemen. Let's dig a little deeper. What are they really talking about? Why did we go to war against Iraq in 1991? I know, oil. Yeah, because the Security Council said it was okay. Why did the American people go along with it? If you remember, right after Iraq invaded Kuwait, Secretary of State James Baker came out and was asked that question, why are we going to fight Iraq? And he said, because of oil. And immediately he was told to shut up by the White House because the president looked out of the Oval Office into Lafayette Square and he saw a lot of American citizens running around with signs saying, no American blood for oil. Clearly, Americans were not prepared to give the blood of their servicemen and women in defense of oil. They had to come up with another reason. Well, it certainly wasn't going to be to defend Kuwaiti democracy. No, the reason was a crusade of good versus evil. You see, we had a problem here. This guy named Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Now, if we wanted to talk about Saddam Hussein in 1990, remember that before he invaded Kuwait, he just happened to be a pretty good friend of the United States. Now, it would be difficult for the president to talk to the American people and tell them the truth. The truth that for the past decade, we helped arm Iraq, we supported Iraq, we condoned Iraq's use of chemical weapons against Iranians and Kurds. It'd be hard for the president to explain why a few months before August, in the spring of 1990, a group of senators traveled to Baghdad, met with Saddam Hussein, and embraced him as a true friend of the American people. How do you go to war against a true friend of the American people? You don't. You demonize them. You see, you don't want to talk about the reality of American-Iraqi relations. You need an enemy. And we turned Saddam Hussein into the personification of evil. We were told that Saddam Hussein is the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler. That Saddam Hussein is all that is evil. Now, when you take this, what you're doing is creating a situation that's black and white. We all know that life isn't that easy. Life is actually a whole bunch of shades of gray. That's called reality. When you define a problem in terms of black and white, it's not a realistic definition of the problem. The other problem is, By defining it in black and white, you come up with a solution. The solution also has to be determined in black and white, which means you have an unrealistic definition of the problem, and now you have an unrealistic solution. Well, the solution to this problem of Saddam Hussein is evil was American troops going off to wage a crusade against evil. And it was a hard sell to the American public, but the president was successful in getting a resolution passed through Congress supporting a war. And 700,000 American troops went off to fight in this conflict. Now, the American people were told that this was a crusade. America versus evil. We're going to hold Saddam Hussein accountable. We're going to take the devil down. Except the international community, in passing its resolution, only said we're going to liberate Kuwait. That's what the war was about. So the war ends, we liberate Kuwait, the American troops come home, and there's great parades in the streets of Washington, D.C. and New York City. And in the background, there's a couple hands going up going, excuse me, Mr. President, excuse me. You told us we were going to war against evil, and you defined evil as Saddam Hussein, and the troops are home declaring victory. And yet when I look in Baghdad, there he's still sitting. Did we win the war? The president suddenly had a political problem. And the problem was defined as Saddam Hussein. Now, how do you deal with Saddam Hussein? You got to get rid of him. But the troops are home. So now, how do you come up with a solution to get rid of Saddam Hussein? Well, first thing you do is you bring all your smart guys together in the White House and you say, Saddam, what's going to happen? And they all scratch their head and they say, he's been defeated militarily. His economy's in tatters. If we can just put a little bit more pressure on him, contain him, and put a little bit more pressure on him, he won't last 6 months. Now, I'm not making this up. Secretary of State James Baker, Richard Haass, and the National Security Council, 6 months is what they gave Saddam Hussein at the end of the Gulf War. 6 months. All we have to do is contain him for 6 months, and he will go away. Now, how do you contain them? Economic sanctions. But a little piece of inconvenience, Kuwait is liberated. We no longer have an excuse for economic sanctions. We need a new excuse. Enter weapons of mass destruction. Pass a resolution citing Iraq's weapons of mass destruction as a clear and present risk to international peace and security, and link the lifting of economic sanctions to Iraq's compliance with its obligation to be disarmed. Furthermore, you make the resolution so stringent and harsh that for Saddam Hussein to accept the terms of his disarmament, he will be discredited in the eyes of the Iraqi people, and they will remove him from power. Are you getting what the resolution was about? The disarmament resolution was never about disarming Iraq, and always about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. And so they passed the resolution. Now, silly inspectors go in thinking they're really going to try and disarm Iraq, but the purpose actually was to contain Iraq until Saddam Hussein fell. And so the Bush administration sat back and watched the months tick by. 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, six. Saddam's still there. Their grand theory failed. Now what do? You got to disarm them, because that's what the resolution says. So the inspectors go in to complete a job they were never intended to do, disarm Iraq. Now Saddam Hussein, the reason why he survived is Saddam Hussein knows Iraq a hell of a lot better than we do. Okay, that's a reality. He knew that if he gave in to these requirements to disarm, he would be discredited and he would be overthrown. So Saddam Hussein opposed the measures to be disarmed. He lied. He cheated. He concealed. And the inspectors had to overcome this. That's where I came in. If you look at my resume, you know, I talk about chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, rockets. You won't see physicist, chemist, biologist, or rocket scientist in my resume. I'm none of those. Those guys are much smarter than I am. I'm an intelligence officer. My job is to gather information. The way the inspections were supposed to work is that Iraq was to turn over a declaration listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction, the information that would fuel the inspection process. But when they lied, they turned over an incomplete declaration. They failed to declare a nuclear weapons program, a biological weapons program, most of their missiles, a lot of their chemical weapons. They just didn't declare it. So now, initially, the United States wasn't worried about that. A false declaration, who cares? 6 months, Saddam's gone, we'll go in, it'll all be cleaned up. But now Saddam's still there, we got to deal with it. If the Iraqis aren't going to give us information, we got to go get it ourselves. We need to enter the game of intelligence, get this information. In I come, form an intelligence unit, off I march, get the data we need. To make a long story short, the Iraqis didn't fully cooperate, but after 5 years, in 1996, we were able to ascertain that Iraq was fundamentally disarmed. 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs were accounted for. This includes 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, all of the associated production equipment related to those factories, and the vast majority of the product produced by these factories. 95%, ladies and gentlemen, that's a hell of a great accomplishment. And nobody thought we could do it, especially the United States. You see, it was never about disarming Iraq. You have to understand that. It was about containing Saddam Hussein. And you contain Saddam Hussein with economic sanctions. And the economic sanctions are justified as long as Iraq is seen as not complying with the weapons inspectors. But what happens when the weapons inspectors start succeeding? You threaten the big plan. You see, if we actually ever disarmed Iraq, the law says sanctions have to be lifted. And if you lift the sanctions, you break containment. And if you break containment, Iraq comes back into the family, the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still at the helm, which is not what the master plan calls for. You don't want the inspectors to succeed. But that's okay, you see, because you passed a stringent resolution that called for 100%, not 95%. So even if we come up and say, hey, we've done this great job, 95%, not only 95% accounted for, but get this, in addition to disarming Iraq, we monitored Iraq. We had inspectors in Iraq covering the totality of Iraq's industrial infrastructure with cameras, sensors, no-notice inspections. For 4 years, 1994 to 1998, the Iraqis never obstructed this work, and we never found any evidence of retained prohibited capability or reconstitution of prohibited capability. So that sort of mitigates this remaining 5%. You know, where is it? We didn't find it. We can't account for it. We don't know what the final disposition is, but we don't have any evidence that says Iraq actually has it. We just don't know where it is. I don't know about you, but I can't find 100% of anything in my closet. Does that mean I'm a liar or a criminal? No, it just means I'm a human being. And something as complicated as Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs, especially after bombing and trying to conceal and a whole bunch of other issues, it's virtually impossible to come up with 100%. So 95% is a darn good figure, but not good enough under the law. Not good enough under the law. We needed 100%. Not because we need to disarm Iraq, but we need to justify the continuation of sanctions. Now, when you say you got to get rid of Saddam Hussein, though, and that, of course, is the policy of the United States, getting rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, initially, it's a passive policy, as put forward by the first Bush administration. Again, we just surround Saddam with sanctions, we put pressure on him, and he disappears. Well, Saddam didn't disappear. Bush did. Clinton comes in. Clinton comes in, and Clinton said an amazing thing. He said, I'm a Southern Baptist, and I believe in deathbed conversions. I think we can get Saddam to change his spots. I think if we just talk to this guy, we can get him to see the reason, and we can resolve this whole thing. An interesting concept, except for one thing. Congress shot him down. Why? Because Saddam Hussein had been demonized in the psyche of the American public to the extent that no one was willing to accept a deal with the devils. You see, when you characterize somebody as the devil, you make it impossible to deal with him. Impossible. No congressman was willing to stand up and say, I support engagement with Saddam Hussein to his constituents, because his constituents would say, how can you deal with the devil? He now has a political vulnerability that can be exploited by an opponent who says, this man's soft on Saddam. That's the end of it. You're gone. So no congressman would support it. Bill Clinton got slapped down and was forced to inherit this policy of containment. But Clinton said, you know, I'm not just going to sit here and wait for Saddam to go. I'm going to help him go. CIA, come on in, boys. Go get him. And the CIA tried. They launched 4 coups in the period of 4 years. And they all failed. Why? Because Saddam Hussein has one of the most brutally efficient security services the world has ever seen. Saddam Hussein is virtually coup-proof. You're just not going to get close enough to him to apply the 75-cent solution, which is the cost of one bullet in the head. It isn't going to happen. So you contain him. Now, back to the inspectors. Here we are, 95%. We've done a good job, but we have to get it remaining 5%. I told you about my resume, that I'm not a physicist or a chemist or a biologist or a rocket scientist, but I did take fifth grade science. And fifth grade science taught me about the nervous system of a frog. Now, what does that have to do with weapons inspections? A lot. You see, I knew in my frog class that if I took a pin and poked a frog, I found out what cause and effect was, the nervous system. Now, this might be prohibited today. I don't know about prevention for cruelty to animals, but this is what happened when I was in fifth grade. Cause and effect. We have to go after the weapons. We don't know where they are. We don't even know if they exist. But we have a piece of information that says that they're being protected by Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. Now, there's no master book sitting in the library called Saddam Hussein's Security Apparatus. You can pull off the shelf, open up, flip to the pages and go, up, concealment of weapons of mass destruction, page 46. They're hidden in the following facilities. No, it doesn't work that way. We don't know anything about this guy, how his protection services work. So we have to launch this great frog experiment. We send inspectors into Baghdad, knock on a door of Saddam Hussein's security barracks, and then see how the Iraqis respond. And it's a fun game, you see. We get to fly airplanes over Baghdad taking pictures. I get to put teams inside Baghdad with headphones on, spinning the dials, intercepting conversations of senior Iraqi leaders. I get to recruit guys and put them inside the facility so they can report on what's happening. It's called collecting data. And we see how the Iraqis respond. We go to the first facility, come in, the Iraqis, they're moving around. Giant experiment, collecting data, guys, collect data, collect data. Go to the next facility. We're coming in, collect data, collect data, collect data. Compare the data, find out where you get points of intersection, focus on it, and keep the experiment going until you get a cause and effect relationship that tells you which parts of the Iraqi security apparatus respond to the inspection input. Nice concept, and it worked, except for one thing. You see, the law that gave me the right to go to every one of those facilities, the Security Council resolution, also said that we had to respect the dignity, sovereignty, and national security of Iraq. And after a while, Iraq went, whoa, what do these facilities have to do with weapons of mass destruction? And we couldn't answer that question. We just said, we have a right to go here. And they said, nope, you're not coming in. Now we had an impasse. We couldn't go into the facility, giant obstruction. Now you probably saw this on TV. You've seen the video clips. Scott Ritter standing there with his hands on his hips, putting his hand like this, saying, I have to go in. Some unfortunate Iraqi soldier with a black beret saying, no, 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 you can't come in. And everybody who saw that assumed that behind that door were weapons of mass destruction. No, we didn't know what was behind there. We were just doing it to provoke a response. And we got it. An AK-47 in our face that said, you can't go in. So now we have an impasse. We have to resolve it. In comes a Swedish diplomat named Rolf Ekéus. He flies to Baghdad. He meets with Tariq Aziz. Tariq Aziz says, these sites are sensitive to our security. Rolf Ekéus says, we get to go anywhere we want to. Compromise. The modalities for sensitive site inspections. When inspectors show up at one of these facilities, the Iraqis have a right to declare it sensitive. In doing so, they limit the size of the inspection team to 4 people. See, prior to that, it was Scott Ritter and 40 other to 60 other inspectors pouring in, taking it down brick by brick. That's okay if it's a factory, but when it's Saddam Hussein's bodyguard unit and we're leafing through documents that contain the secret codes and the location of Saddam and how he's protected, they don't like that. So 4 guys go in, we get to do anything we want, and if we determine that the site has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, we leave. If, however, we find out there's something related to our mandate, send in the cavalry, we get to do whatever we want to do. And you know what? This worked. From 1996 to 1998, it didn't work perfectly, but we got into every facility we wanted to get into. We investigated. We did more cause and effect relationship. We started to narrow down the targets. And you know what we started to find? That there's a heck of a lot of concealment taking place in Iraq related to the weapons inspectors. You know what they were concealing, though? Not weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein's security secrets. They still care about the protection of their president. And why shouldn't they? The United States has a policy of taking them out. And the last thing they want is some 6'4", 220-pound Marine coming in and grabbing this secret. So they hide it. They hide it. And we started to close in on the reality that there's probably no weapons left in Iraq. Oh, this is a very dangerous thing, though, if you're an American. An American who supports a policy of continuing to contain Saddam until the CIA can figure out a way to get rid of him. Now, remember, the CIA failed. And the reason why they failed is because they didn't know anything about Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. Well, guess what, ladies and gentlemen? Scott Ritter just handed them a birthday gift. I gave them the keys to the presidential palaces. I gave them the keys to understanding where Saddam sleeps at night, how his convoys operate, who protects him, how they protect him, when they protect him, where they protect him. Suddenly, the United States had the ability to get rid of Saddam Hussein, courtesy of the United Nations. Now, we didn't do it on purpose. It's not as though we went in there and said, we're going to collect this data and turn it over to the United States and they can get rid of Saddam. We went in there trying to resolve the issue, and we did. We resolved the issue. We investigated the issue. We found out that there's probably nothing left. So the United States now has to act, and act quickly. It has to do two things. One, it needs to get rid of Saddam Hussein. And failing that, get rid of the inspectors, because the inspectors are starting to threaten their policy of regime removal. December 1998, the United States prevails upon the weapons inspectors to send a team to Baghdad. The team is told to go to sites that are deliberately provocative. One of these sites is the Adamiya Ba'ath Party headquarters. Ba'ath Party headquarters, that's a political party, not a weapons factory. The inspectors show up and the Iraqis go, this is a sensitive site. You're welcome to come in accordance with the modalities of census site inspections. And the inspectors, under order from Richard Butler, the Australian who took over from Rolf Acacius in the summer of 1997, ripped up the modalities and said they no longer apply. Why did they do that? Because the United States ordered them to do that. Why did the United States order them to do that? Because they knew what the Iraqis would do, which is, if the modalities don't apply, you can't come in. And now the inspectors report back. The Iraqis are not cooperating. And the United States orders the inspectors out and then bombs Iraq, using this non-cooperation as justification for military action. Furthermore, all that nice intelligence information that we gathered about Iraq's security was used to target Iraq, to bomb facilities, to go after Saddam Hussein. More than 120 targets were struck. Less than a dozen of them dealt with industrial capabilities with potential use in weapons of mass destruction. And even those dozen were subjected to monitoring by inspectors, and we knew damn well there wasn't anything bad happening in those factories, but we blew them up anyways. But most of the targets were Saddam's security sites. Now, we didn't get Saddam. We very rarely do get these guys that we go after. We don't have a good record in Special Forces. We call it a Where's Waldo exercise. You know that cartoon where you're looking for Waldo? We don't do Where's Waldo very well. Just ask Mohammed Faraday Deed. Just ask Osama bin Laden. And maybe you'll get to ask Saddam Hussein. We don't do this very well. We failed in December 1998 to get Saddam, but we did succeed in killing the inspectors because the Iraqis aren't stupid. They knew what happened. And they turned around and said, the inspectors aren't welcome to come back in because you're nothing more than spies in the United States of America. And unfortunately, they were right. They were right. So that's the situation. That's the situation we face today, ladies and gentlemen. No inspectors in Iraq. Now, I resigned in 1998, before December 1998. I resigned in August because I said, I'm not going to be part of this game. I'm not getting part of this charade. You see, I believe in the rule of law. I believe that Saddam Hussein must be held fully accountable to the law. I view Saddam Hussein as a criminal. And I view myself and the other inspectors as police officers who are carrying out an investigation of a criminal. But what happens when you have a criminal? Let's call him a drug dealer. Four-time convicted drug dealer. Now he's back out of jail. He's on the streets, and we think he's running a crack house on the corner. So the cops come in. Now, if the cops run a clean investigation and they get the goods on the guy, he's held accountable to the rule of law. Off to jail he goes. But what happens if the cops plant evidence? What happens if the cops do an illegal wiretap? What happens if they do an illegal search and seizure? The case is thrown out. Now, does this mean that the drug dealer is not a criminal? No, it doesn't. But it means the cops broke the law. The cops became corrupt. Ladies and gentlemen, the inspectors broke the law. The inspectors became corrupt. We were no longer able to maintain the integrity of the prosecution. This doesn't mean, though, that Saddam Hussein is no longer a threat. When I resigned, I clearly stated that Iraq had not been disarmed fully in accordance with the law, and they hadn't. The law says 100%, we could attest to 95%. I also stated that once you remove inspectors from Iraq, Iraq will be able to take its civilian infrastructure and convert it to produce weapons of mass destruction within a period of 6 months. And inspectors have been away from Iraq now for almost 4 years. So it's very easy for the Bush administration to say the Iraqis could have rebuilt their weapons program in the intervening 4 years. And you know, with no weapons inspectors in Iraq, that's a mythology that can carry some weight. The Bush administration has told you that this is a war that's going to be fought because of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Nope. Can't buy that one anymore, ladies and gentlemen. Why? The Iraqis just said they're willing to let the inspectors back in to come in and do the job, hold them fully accountable to the law. And the Bush administration wouldn't take yes for an answer. Shut the door on the inspectors. So, ladies and gentlemen, let's dispel the first myth. It's not about weapons of mass destruction. Iraq doesn't have them. They don't pose a threat to anyone. Let's make that clear. Now, we've also been told by the president that Saddam Hussein is an evil man. No debate here. We've been told that Saddam Hussein is a criminal. The president stood before the United Nations and said Saddam Hussein's in violation of 16 resolutions. That Saddam Hussein has committed crimes against humanity. And I say, yes, Mr. President, I agree. And because I am someone who believes in the rule of law, I believe we should hold Saddam Hussein accountable to the rule of law. I want an indictment of Saddam Hussein in the International Court of Justice. If you want regime removal, indict Saddam. Oh, wait, whoa, I forgot something. I forgot something, though. We don't support the International Court of Justice. We don't support the rule of law. So what's this about? It's not about weapons of mass destruction. It's not about Saddam Hussein. Ladies and gentlemen, what's it about? I'm going to introduce you to another piece of paper. It's called the National Security Strategy Document put out by the Bush administration 2 weeks ago. You know what this document says? This document says that the United States of America will take advantage of its overwhelming military and economic strength to impose a unilateral American solution on the world, regardless of international law. You know what this document says, ladies and gentlemen? It says that the United States is going to become an imperial power. Well, it may be, but now we're finally admitting it. It's a blatant admission that the United States is giving up on international law, that the United States will preemptively strike out anytime we see fit. Not what the international community says, not what law says, but when we unilaterally determine that there's a situation in the globe that we don't like, we will act unilaterally. Now, you want to know why we're going to war with Iraq? Because Iraq is the initial case study of implementation of an American policy of unilateral action, and we must stop it. Now, this is not, thank you. This is not going to be an easy struggle. This is not going to be an easy struggle at all. It's one that's going to be fought using vicious tactics by the other side. And I hate to say it, but there is another side. Ladies and gentlemen, I know everybody out here is a peaceful spirit. You're religious people. You believe in peace. And I support that. But you've got to start thinking like a military person. President Bush is speaking of waging war. I urge you to wage peace. Wage peace in the same manner. What this means is that you have to wake up to the harsh reality. Now, when I, as a Marine Corps officer, I took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Representative Jim McDermott took the same oath. The same oath. This means foreign and domestic. We have a domestic threat today against the Constitution of the United States, and it resides in Washington, D.C. And we need to wage peace. We need to wage peace, and it's not going to be easy. No, they're going to bring out all the tactics. First thing we have to understand to wage peace is what we're fighting for, American democracy, plain and simple. That's what we're fighting for. Now, what does American democracy mean? You know, I come from New York. I know, bad place. But in Albany, New York, we had an issue. The Hudson River. General Electric dumped some PCBs in it. It was polluted, and they were talking about dredging the river. And it was a big issue. Do you dredge it? Do you don't dredge it? And there were a lot of people concerned about this. And the citizens got up, rose up, got together, formed civic action groups. And there were pros and there were cons, and they debated. They held their elected representatives accountable. They had town hall meetings, brought them forward, discussed it. And in the end, there was a vote, and one side won. But at the end of the vote, when that one side won, you didn't see anybody reaching over and saying, all those who opposed us are traitors. All those who opposed us are unpatriotic. No, everybody was a patriot because they participated in American democracy. That's what it's about. Now we have a situation today. We have a situation today that's very grave. We're talking about going to war with Iraq. And what's lacking is that kind of democratic involvement. Where's the debate? Where's the discussion? Where's the dialogue? Where are the people? There's been no debate. Well, there might be on the TV, but I'll tell you what. You guys are blessed. You are blessed with a representative who had the courage to step out, go to Baghdad, and get the facts. Now, Jim McDermott has been criticized by some for daring to speak out against the policy of President Bush. Not because he spoke out. No. Hey, he said the same words on the steps of the Capitol in Washington, D.C. The exact same words, but not a damn person was listening. So Jim McDermott waged peace. He went to Baghdad, he seized the bully pulpit, and he repeated his words. He repeated his words, and guess what? The world listened. And that was viewed as a threat by the Bush administration, by those neoconservatives who are pushing for war. So they attacked him. They attacked his patriotism. They questioned his loyalty to this great country, when in fact, he alone of people is the true patriot. He went forward. He gathered the data. And the people of Seattle owe him a debt. Mr. McDermott, thank you. Now, you got to understand how hard that was as a card-carrying member of the Republican Party. But seriously, the fact is, though, it's going to be a difficult struggle, ladies and gentlemen, a difficult struggle to wage peace, to stop a war, and we are running out of time. We are running out of time. The Bush administration is right now, unfortunately, the equivalent of a used car salesman. They're pulling a quick one on us. They're trying to get this war pushed, they're trying to get this war accomplished, and they're doing it rapidly. They are trying to push a war powers resolution through Congress as we speak. And it appears that Congress is going to cave in. There's a couple exceptions. There's a brave senator from West Virginia named Robert Byrd who is standing up right now as we speak. And he is holding up the Constitution of the United States, and he's saying, shame, shame, shame. This document is what we stand for. He needs help. He needs reinforcements. We need to find a way to tell Congress that they must look to the Constitution for guidance on how to respond to pressure from the White House to go to war. And when you look, I'm going to just bring this up. I travel around the world quite a bit talking about this issue, and there's a heck of a lot of anti-American sentiment out there today. I think you have to understand that. We are not well-loved, and for good reason. But I always chastise those who shout, "Down, down, USA," because I tell them that the American people are a good people. The American people are not evil. That the American people want to do the right thing, but the American people are scared right now. The American people have been callously manipulated by the Bush administration, playing upon the politics of fear and ignorance, exploiting the horror that we felt on September 11th to cow us into submission. We are told that we are at war. And when we are at war against terror, you're either with us or you're against us. There's no room for neutrality for those who say, "I don't know." See, if you say, "I don't know," you're not with us, so you must be against us. There's no room for those who raise their hand and say, "Excuse me, Mr. President, I have a question. If you question me, you're not with me, you're against me, you're not a patriot, you're a traitor." This is what we're fighting. This is what we're fighting. And what I tell the Europeans is that we need help. We need people to lead by example. We need our fellow democracies in Canada and Great Britain to help. And you know they are helping. In Great Britain last weekend, 450,000 people came to the streets to protest against war. And that was a signal that Tony Blair could not ignore. No, Tony Blair wanted to go to his Labour Party conference and push through a resolution that say, "I, Tony Blair, will side with the United States no matter what George Bush says." And the people of England, the British democracy, said, "Not in our name. If you go to war, it's only with the approval of the United Nations." And that's what happened. Success. And I asked the British people, I said, "Quit criticizing us. Quit saying, 'Down, down, USA.' You're our friends. Be our friends." You guys know the saying, "Friends don't let friends drive drunk." Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have a drunk at the wheel of American foreign policy named George Bush. Drunk with power, drunk with arrogance, and we need help in reaching over and taking the keys out of the ignition so he doesn't drive this vehicle off the edge of a cliff. Now, here's the question I have for you. I see desire. I see desire, but do you have the will for peace? Okay. Senator Byrd, right now, is waging peace in our name by holding up the Constitution and saying, "Shame on you, Mr. President," but he needs help. Congress will be convening in a short period of time. I believe by September or by October 18th. So we don't have that much time, ladies and gentlemen. You want to wage peace? We need 1 million people to gather in Washington, D.C., holding the Constitution of the United States of America, surrounding the United States Congress, and saying, "Read the document, not in our name. No war, no way." Do you have the will? Do you have the will? Now, I came here tonight to help stimulate debate, discussion, and dialogue, but frankly speaking, the time is getting late. There's no more time for talk. It is time for action. The calendar, the date you should set on your calendar is the weekend of September 12th and 13th. Excuse me. See, there I am, a simple Marine. I don't even know how to tell time. October 12th and 13th. October 12th and 13th. We're running short of time. It's going to take dramatic action. You have to decide what signal you're going to send to future generations. People ask me why I'm here, why I'm doing this, and I'm doing it for my kids. I'm doing it to defend the nation I want my kids to grow up in. I don't want my kids to grow up in an American imperial power. I want them to grow up in an American democratic power, and it's power of the people, by the people, for the people. You need to take action now. Let's be very clear here. This is not going to be easy. It's going to require reaching out across your city, across your state, across your region, across your country. We need to send a signal loud and clear to Washington, D.C. that war will not be tolerated, that the Constitution will be defended, and that signal must resonate starting here tonight in Seattle. Will you help sound the signal? Now, I'll take that as a yes. I'll take that as a yes. And now we're going to run a little exercise here. I've asked you to consider holding your elected representatives accountable for what they do in your name. Hold the president accountable for what he does in your name. He works for you. Hold Congress accountable for what they do in your name. And now I'm going to say, hold me accountable for what I've said here tonight. Let's begin the exchange of ideas, the exchange of discussion. Let's start the debate. I'm ready to take any questions anybody has. Thank you very much.
Rich Gamble is going to come now and explain our process. If you can get your questions to the center aisle, I believe the ushers are already taking them up.
Your questions are, there's about a stack a foot high as I look up here. They're excellent questions, and thank you. Here are two that I think are related. One is, I've heard that you received financial support from Iraq. Is this true? The other is, Secretary Powell has said, why take Scott Ritter seriously? He's outside the current intelligence loop.
Okay, well, how about that? I'll deal with the Secretary's statement first. Yeah, I agree, Mr. Secretary. I'm outside of the loop. I haven't been in the intelligence business now for 4 years. So, no problem. But as a 12-year veteran of the intelligence service and as an American citizen, just because I'm no longer in the loop doesn't mean I can't think. And when I'm told by the Bush administration that they know Iraq has chemical weapons and they know Iraq has biological weapons, now I'm a simple Marine, I don't have total grasp of the English language, that implies certainty of knowledge. I'd certainly like to know what the facts are. I don't need to be in the intelligence loop to want to know how they know that so I can support their call for war. You know, just think of yourself if going to your doctor and you walk into your doctor and he says, my goodness, you got a brain tumor in your head, and we lie down on the table right now, I'm lopping off the top of your head and I'm going to take the brain tumor out. Well, you know, Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction have been given to us is the equivalent of a cancer that needs to be excised. Okay, I support that, but wouldn't you say, doctor, could I see the MRI? Could I see the x-ray, please? And if the doctor said, no, trust me, just lay down, let me cut off the top of your head, you'd be a damn fool to do so. I don't need to be in the intelligence loop to ask Mr. Powell to show me the information to substantiate his allegations about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Now, about the money thing. I'm going to do my best not to get angry, because trust me, that question gets me boiling mad. But I'm going to try and maintain my sense of humor here. When I resigned, I made a decision to speak out, to try and promote a debate, to try and promote a discussion. Because I recognize that in order for American democracy to function, the people have to get involved. In order for American democracy to function well, the people have to be empowered with information. And I was trying to offer information to the American public so they could have informed discussion and discourse about the situation in Iraq. I wrote a book. It wasn't paid for by the Iraqis, by the way. I wrote a book, and unfortunately, no one read it. I wrote articles. No one read them. I got on TV. Not too many people watched. There needed to be a way to get this message out, and the way I decided to pursue was a documentary film. Now, I came up with the idea, my idea, I'm initiating this, and I traveled around to different media outlets and said, I'd like to produce a documentary. I think I can get into Iraq, and I think I can get the Iraqis to let me interview them, and I can interview inspectors, and I can tell the truth about the inspections to let the American public see for themselves what the reality is of this process, why it started, what they did, and what the final outcome was. And no one wanted to make this film. Now, I was testifying at a hearing in Congress, and there were some people in the audience. One of the people that stood up afterwards was an American citizen of Iraqi origin from Detroit, a Detroit area businessman. Now, he came up and he said, "What are you doing to get your message out?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to make a documentary." He said, "How much would it cost?" And I said, $400,000. He said, "I'll write the check." And I said, "Time out. So what's your name?" He said, "Shakir Al-Khafaji." I said, "You're an Iraqi, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Whoa, I don't want to go down that path, you know, because I want this film to be pure." But he said, "You ain't going to get anybody else to write the check." So I went to Detroit. I sat down with him and his lawyer, and I said, "Show me where the money's coming from." And he showed me the stocks and bonds that he was liquidating from his own resources to fund the film. And I said, "Would you sign a contract and a guarantee that says you're not getting a quid pro quo arrangement with the Iraqi government, giving me your money and they're feeding money in the back channel?" He signed the assurances. He signed a contract that said he will have no editorial input in the movie. It's my movie. Imagine that. Handing me $400,000 and saying, "Make whatever movie you want to make." That's pretty stunning. But I still wasn't happy. So I went to the FBI and said, "As I make this film, I want an ongoing investigation into the funding here. If you find any reason to believe that there is a quid pro quo arrangement or any other aspect of this that shows this money is tainted, tell me and I will pull the plug on this movie, because I will not make anything that can be perceived as a piece of Iraqi propaganda." Ladies and gentlemen, there is a movie made today called In Shifting Sands, and it is the best damn documentary you're going to find about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and the true state of disarmament. And we owed a debt of gratitude to an American citizen named Shakir Al-Khafaji, who funded the film. Without him, the American public would not have access to this movie. So that's how I respond to the issue of $400,000.
Encourages us to get past too much debate and get on to action. This question asks, what, just to elaborate on the actions you recommend the weekend of October 12th and 13th, as specifically as you can.
Say again?
Where can you see the film?
We're working on that. You know, the problem is, let me answer that. The film was given a cold shoulder by the American media. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, too, my God, look at the crowd tonight, and where the hell's the media? Where are they? Besides them.
Let's do a little roll call and call our media president. King 5, are you here? Anybody from King 5? Anybody here want to ask King 5 why they're not here tonight? Cairo, are you here? Anybody from Cairo? Anybody want to ask Cairo why they're not here? Cairo Radio is here. Good. Popo. Is Popo here? No one from Como. Pretty important issue, Como. Anybody want to ask Como why they're not here? Seattle PI has the foreign desk editor. Interrupt me from Como? PI. Seattle PI has the foreign desk editor in Iraq with a photographer at this point filing stories for the day. KCTS was here, I know. I think they left early, but they did take this. And Seattle Times. Anyone from Seattle Times? Seattle Times is here. IndyMedia is here.
Okay, so let me say, the film now is getting the attention I think it deserves, probably because I went to Baghdad and stirred up the pot. It's been sold now to 5 European countries. It's been sold to Canada. Remember, this $400,000, it wasn't a gift. It was a loan. I'm on the hook for it. So, you know, we're trying to sell it and get the money back to pay off the investor. It's opened in San Francisco to rave reviews. It's going to open up in 2 theaters in New York City, and we hope to get it opened up in cities around the United States. And soon, thanks to the generous support of some Hollywood producers, it's going to be out on home video. So hopefully every American will have a chance to see this movie in the near future. Now, about the 12th and 13th, hey, I just threw out an idea. It's up to you to take this idea and run with it. You know, Tony Blair was shown 450,000 reasons why he couldn't accept a war on Bush's terms. You need to show Bush a million reasons why you're not going to tolerate his frontal assault on the Constitution of the United States. How you choose to do this is your business. I don't know. I'm not an activist. I think it's a darn good idea, though, to give Senator Robert Byrd and all the other people who feel that the Constitution is something worth fighting for some reinforcements.
Excuse me, Scott. What I'm hearing, think military, I'm hearing October 18th, Congress flies away to work on getting reelected. I'm hearing next weekend is the weekend. I'll be in Washington, D.C. next Friday and Saturday, and I want to know how many will go with me. And I want to know who will use all the networking they've got to get these other people in all the other places, Omaha. If it's in Omaha, if it's everywhere. How are we going to get the word out? I don't know what this means. I just know if we don't do it now, we're going to be back having candlelight vigils after the war starts. And I'd rather not do that. I think there is a chance. I think there is a chance to stop this thing. And I don't know of another chance. It's the best one I've heard tonight. It's the one I've been sitting on in my head for 10 years. I'm ready to go.
We're going a little past time. I assume that's okay with everyone. We're going to stop. I fully agree with you, Scott, on this matter, but still I'm curious why a couple of your colleagues, I assume they mean weapons inspector colleagues, are taking the opposite view. Can you respond to that reality?
Well, that's a question you need to ask them. I'll just put this in the proper perspective here. There were thousands of weapons inspectors. There were hundreds of them who worked directly with me in my 7-year experience as a weapons inspector. There are a handful who are being trotted out in front of the media to criticize what I'm saying. Some of the leading names, David Kaye. Now, David Kaye did a darn good job as an inspector in 1991. He left at the end of 1991. How dare David Kaye talk about what I did from 1992 to 1998? He has no idea. And yet he's speaking as though he knows what I accomplished, what I'm doing. I don't know why David Kaye is doing this. I just know he's not qualified to judge, sit in judgment on the inspections I ran. Dick Spurzel is another one, biological inspector, 1994 to 1998. He never served on an inspection team that I was on. He has no clue what I did. What I can say is everything I've said about weapons inspections, the result of weapons inspections, are documented fact as set forth in United Nations Security Council documents put forward by the Special Commission. I'm not making this stuff up. We have inspectors out there right now that are saying that they know Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. My God, if they knew it, how come they didn't record it in a document? How come it's not recorded fact? The fact of the matter is you will not find a single United Nations document that says Iraq retains prohibited weaponry. They will say we can't account for weaponry, but they don't retain it. So you have to ask yourself, what's motivating these people? And I always say follow the money. Follow the money, find out who's paying them, and you'll find out that they're being paid by neoconservative think tanks to promote the concept of war with Iraq. And they are sent out to commit politically motivated character assassination of a voice that is arguing against them. Any inspector who served on my team would never say what they're saying, because every inspector who serves on my team is supporting what I'm saying, and they know that what I'm saying is the fact as I knew it. Fox News tried to ambush me on that challenge. I said, find one inspector. find one inspector on my team who will speak out against me. And they went into London and they pulled out a guy named Chris Cobb Smith, who was my deputy. He's a hard-charging, former Royal Marine, a hawk, a man who has no fear of danger. And they said, this guy, there's no way he could go along with Ritter. He hasn't flipped. They put Chris Cobb Smith, they were going to give him a full day, put him in front of the camera, give him a whole day of telling the whole world what kind of fool and liar Scott Ritter was. So they put him on in the morning program. Camera comes on, and Chris Cobb Smith says, Scott Ritter's absolutely right. Everything he says is the truth, and I agree with 100%. And that was the last time Chris Cobb Smith was in front of the camera.
How can America save face when Saddam Hussein wins, and we can say that Saddam Hussein has already been winning, if I heard you correctly?
Well, I mean, it's not just America saving face. I think we have to understand that this is a political reality. We have a president named George W. Bush who has committed a tremendous amount of political capital behind the concept of removing Saddam Hussein from power. Okay, he's not, but he unfortunately sits in the White House and he carries the title of president, and we have to deal with this reality. And he's going to be president for at least 2 more years. So, and in that 2 years, he can raise a lot of hell and a lot of havoc. So, it's not the United States that has to save face. It's the president that has to save face, especially if you want to stop this war. Now, however unpleasant this concept might be to you sitting in the office, we have to find a way to allow the president to save face. And that's why I brought up the rule of law. The president has said that Saddam must go. Okay, Mr. President, let's indict him. Let's indict Saddam Hussein, hold him accountable for the crimes he's committed against humanity, and then find the mechanism to achieve Saddam's removal. How do we do that? It's pretty easy. Send the inspectors in. Now, the inspectors have been linked with economic sanctions. Now, we all know sanctions are a horrible thing, that sanctions have resulted in an awful toll against the Iraqi civilians, and we want sanctions lifted. Now, sanctions have been justified because they are alleged to compel the Iraqis to comply with their obligation to disarm. But we now know the only thing that got the inspectors back in is the threat of military force. So why continue to abide by the charade of economic sanctions? Get the inspectors back in. When you get a monitoring regime put in place that can effectively monitor how Iraq spends its money, lift the economic sanctions. Then indict Saddam Hussein and his senior leadership as criminals against humanity and pass a new resolution. I'm trying to help you solve this problem. Pass a new resolution that reimposes sanctions on Iraq, but not against the people of Iraq, but the senior leadership of Iraq. And these sanctions can only be lifted when Iraq turns the criminals over to the International Court of Justice. That's how you get rid of Saddam Hussein. That's how you help Bush save face. That's how you stop a war.
Number of people ask this question, Scott. It might help to understand how, knowing what you do in 1998, explain why you voted for George Bush for the Bush administration.
Okay. The fact is, I was disgusted with America's policy on Iraq, especially as it was implemented in 8 years of the Clinton presidency. I saw firsthand how the Clinton presidency lied to me and my fellow inspectors in regards to the threat posed by Iraq. I saw how the Clinton administration sat back and callously ignored the death and suffering of the innocent Iraqi people at the hands of economic sanctions. I was not going to sit back and vote for Al Gore because Al Gore was promising to continue these policies, and in good faith, I couldn't give him my vote. Now, George W. Bush, and this is where I said I'm a pretty simple, naive guy, he got before me. And he said a couple of things. He said, you know, I'm a uniter, not a divider. I believed him. He said, I'm going to reach across party lines and bring in the voice of America to represent me on my cabinet. I believed him. He said that we're a powerful nation, but we are going to conduct foreign policy with humility. We will be humble. I believed him. Ladies and gentlemen, I was a sucker, but I tell you what, fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you. He doesn't get my vote. How about Jim McDermott for president?
If you don't let them know that you exist, they aren't going to vote their, what your ideas are. You got to go down and make them understand in their office that there are a lot of people out here who feel this way. The television isn't here to tell everybody, right? That'd be an article in the newspaper, a few people will see it, but the impact of your going down the federal building and seeing them there and going in large numbers of people, in my view, is the only way it works. We are going to have to overwhelm Washington, D.C. It isn't just Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell. Scott has laid out an idea, which I and the Reverend got up here and talked about it. There are about to be a million people in Washington, D.C. next Saturday. Because we are going to be arguing this bill this week in the House of Representatives, beginning on Tuesday, and there'll be about 20 to 30 hours of debate. And we'll probably vote sometime late on Thursday. Now, the House will have passed it. Then the only hope you have is the Senate. And if you're not there telling them, we see what the House did, they folded and rolled for this guy, and you have got to hold the line. And at that point, all the senators will be watching what's going on in Washington, D.C. I think individually, we've got time to work on Harvard. We actually have to work in Washington, D.C. at this point, because by the 18th of November, 18th of October, we'll be going home, we'll run for election. And then it'll be scattered all over the country. It's much easier to get them in Washington, D.C. And I understand it's a long way from here to there, but during the Vietnam War, people got their cars, they drove. I mean, it's, only about 25 hours straight through if you get your car. Some of you may, some of the old gray heads in this group may have done that. And I see one hand waving back there. And some of you young people have never done anything but fly across this country. That might be a good way. Just rent a bus, get a bunch of people in the bus, and go take a trip. Because Washington, D.C. thinks you're all quiet. So they're all rolling over. They're all rolling over. They're not. You can see, somebody said to me, why aren't more congressmen going to Iraq? You saw that to me, right? The guys that are halfway smart said, I'm not going near that. So the only ways to get your voice heard is to be visible to the extent that the press cannot avoid you as they have tonight. And when the three major stations don't show up, what's that say? Either it says that this isn't a big deal, or it says that the people who run those stations don't want this on TV. Make your own choice about what's true. I'd like to see it once you see the Academy.
Scott, you've already touched on this. This question says, how do you get the message to the conservative parts of the country? Some of us think Seattle is a little easier on this issue than you mentioned Omaha, but Iowa. Could you just elaborate some more on that?
You get the message to the conservative parts the same way you get the message to the easy parts. You go out there and deliver the message. It's as easy as that, to tell you the truth. I've been traveling all over the country in the last 4 years. When the Congress was, when the Senate was getting ready to have these debates or discussions in the Foreign Affairs Committee, they didn't call anybody with real experience before them. They brought together people who basically had a preordained conclusion to go to war against Iraq. So I got together with a couple people and we said, let's pick Senator Brownback's state, Kansas. Let's go to Senator Lugar's state, Indianapolis. Let's go to Maryland, Parsaw Bain's state. And we went. We organized town hall functions like this. We invited the press to come. I did interviews. I did meetings with the editorial boards. And people came. People were educated. Editorials were written. And we got the message out in the heartland of America. That's the only way to get the message out. You can't rely on the media to do it. You got to do it yourself. You got to get up and show that you have the will to achieve peace. That's the only way. There's no easy way. It's going to be hard. But nothing worth doing is ever easy. It always requires a struggle. This is waging peace. This is a struggle worth the effort.
Will you please run for Congress?
No.
Please explain no-fly zones and the legality or basis thereof.
No-fly zones are not a construct of the United Nations Security Council. They are a construct of the United States of America. The first no-fly zone was imposed in northern Iraq in the spring of 1991 in the aftermath of the crackdown by the Iraqi government of Kurdish insurrection. Over 250,000 Kurds fled northern Iraq, some into Iran, some into, most into Turkey. The Turks had their own little Kurdish problem going, and the last thing they needed was 250,000 independent-minded Kurds parking in on their territory. So the Turks turned to America and said, get them out of here. There's no place to send them except back to Iraq. But you couldn't ask them to go back to Iraq with the Iraqi military there ready to slaughter them. So the concept of a safe haven was created, and a resolution was passed. But this resolution didn't invoke Chapter 7. This resolution, I believe, invoked Article 1. It talked about the Secretary General appealing to the community of nations to provide humanitarian assistance to the Kurdish people. The United States, Great Britain, and France stepped up and said, we will send in military troops to create a safe haven so the Kurds can return. And they imposed a no-fly zone over northern Iraq to keep Iraqi military helicopters from coming in. So the no-fly zones were created for the purpose of humanitarian intervention, and it was legitimate. But now the no-fly zones are being used for the purpose of destabilizing the regime in Baghdad by denying Baghdad the ability to rule its own sovereign territory. There is no longer widespread oppression of the Kurds taking place. That could be because of the no-fly zone. I don't know, but I do know this. The American Air Force never dropped a single bomb in defense of the Kurdish people. The American Air Force has never dropped a single bomb in defense of the Shia in the south. There is a southern no-fly zone. It was created in 1992, again, out of pressure from Kuwait, which wanted assurances that the Iraqi military would not come down near the Kuwaiti border and again threaten to invade. They use as an excuse to create this no-fly zone Iraqi oppression of the Shia population in the south. But again, I say, there was no Security Council resolution that did this. It was a unilateral action on the part of the United States. Frankly speaking, the no-fly zones are a violation of international law. There is nothing to support American military aircraft violating the sovereign airspace of Iraq. Nothing whatsoever. And this is very troublesome because we're bombing Iraq. You know, people say we're going to go to war with Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, we're at war with Iraq. We already fly hundreds of combat sorties over Iraqi territory every single day. Several times a week now, we drop bombs on Iraq. The reason why we drop bombs on Iraq is that the Iraqi air defense units are shooting at our airplanes as we fly over the sovereign airspace of Iraq. And we say we're bombing in self-defense, which is okay. Look, if I were an American military officer and my pilots are getting shot at, I'm going to bomb. I'm going to take out the threat. That's understandable. What's not understandable is why are we there? We shouldn't be there to begin with.
Just a request to repeat the name of the document you cited, the security document that came out a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, it's a National Security Strategy document.
I believe it's available on the internet, if that helps anyone develop.
There was a part. It's a classified document, but there was a partial excerpt of it in the New York Times about a week and a half ago.
Thank you. discuss the chicken hawk advisors to George Bush, Cheney, Pearl, Wolfowitz, etc. Why does Bush ignore the Joint Chiefs of Staff?
Whoa. Look, you know, this is about as close to a coup as I can think of occurring in modern American history. We have a situation where, I mean, I'm not a politician, but I've studied American political history. We have a situation where Bush ran for president, lost the popular vote, and snuck in on a technicality in Florida. He doesn't have a mandate. He does not have a mandate to lead. What happens to a politician when they don't have a mandate? They fall in on their political base, and President Bush's political base is the far-right neoconservative wing of the Republican Party. So he turned to the far-right neoconservative wing of the Republican Party to support him, which means that he plucked these neocons, these Wolfowitzes, these Pearls, these Rumsfelds, people who had no future in American politics. He plucked them out of obscurity and empowered them, gave them important positions. These people are not reflective of mainstream American political thought. They are reflective of right-wing neoconservatives. Now, the sad fact is that these people have been for some time now espousing this philosophy of unilateralism, this Pax Americana. And it's up until recently, it's just been a theory put forward by radical right-wing thinkers. But now that they are empowered, they get to implement this policy as if it's reflective of American thought and American ideal. It's not. They have hijacked the national security of the United States in pursuit of their own politically motivated ideology. And this is wrong. And what makes it morally wrong, in addition to just the crime of assaulting the Constitution, is that we have people pushing for war who never wore the uniform. People who are talking about going to war who found that the Vietnam War was inconvenient for their political future. People who don't know what the cost of war really is. And this, to me, is particularly disturbing.
Let me ask this question and let both of you respond to it, if you would first, Jim. If, in your view, if we go to war on Iraq, which way will Turkey, Jordan, and Syria go?
Scott and I had a discussion about this a little earlier. If war starts, one of the unknowns and one of the scariest parts of the whole thing is, it's like throwing a can of gasoline on a bonfire. You don't know what's going to happen. My feeling is if war starts in Iraq and it's not resolved pretty quickly, and I don't think it will be because we're going to have house-to-house fighting in a city the size of Detroit, one house at a time. If we have that going on in Iraq for very long, you're going to watch the Jordanian government, which is already shaky, and tell the king is not, he's a Hashemite, he's of the minority there. You've got the same kinds of situations going on all over, and I personally think the Middle East will explode. I think we are really beginning a massive situation over which we have no control. Once you light a fire, you don't know where it goes. It's like lighting a fire, a campfire in the forest. You know, these people who burn down half the forest. They say, well, I was just cooking my hamburger. But in fact, what happened was it got away from them, and I think that's the real threat of this whole situation, is that all of these countries are the Mubarak in Egypt has already said, if you attack over there, I'm going to lose control here. Because he's been fighting his Islamist fundamentalists there for a long time, and Egypt will go, and so forth and so on.
Well, yes, it is exactly what Bush wants. What you know, this is the irony. I was debating this issue with Richard Pearl, the Prince of Darkness, on radio a little while ago. It's not what I call him. It's what he calls himself, by the way, proudly. And we were talking, and this question was asked. And I said, you know, the same response that, that Jim just said. I said, you know, the whole region will be destabilized. We have the potential of having you know, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, etc., all collapse into anarchy and chaos. And, you know, we're opening a Pandora's box, etc. And the announcer turns to Richard Pearl and says, well, Scott Ritter's just laid out a pretty dreadful scenario here of instability and such. How do you respond to that? And Richard Pearl said, and the problem is? And I'm dead serious. You see, part of this Pax Americana talks about failed nations and failed regions. And in the mindset of the neoconservatives right now, who have control of the national security of the United States, they view the Middle East as a failed region. They say that the Middle East is imprisoned by centuries-old traditions of theocracy and feudalism, and that what needs to happen in the Middle East is a revolution that kicks out these old habits and brings in Western-style liberal democracy along the American model. Now, I'm a student of history, and I tell you what, I love my country and I love American democracy. I recognize it's not perfect, but we have a lot, we can improve on this greatly. But I do know one thing. When that Constitution was signed, you know, a lot happened between then and now. We fought a revolution. We fought a civil war. We fought two world wars. We emancipated the slaves. Women won suffrage. We had a civil rights struggle. We had the horrors of the Vietnam War. We have much going on. What this means is that the American democracy today is reflective of over 220 years of uniquely American experience. And it is the height of arrogance to suggest that we can take this model and cookie cutter apply it on other nations without considering their own unique experience.
With regret, we must end. I wish we could go on, and we will in other ways. It is getting late in our...